Blog Talk Radio.
Archangels, ghosts, and Bigfoot, oh my. It's just another night for Supernatural Girls. Real stories, real answers to life's biggest supernatural mysteries. And now for another exciting interview with paranormal experts from this world and others. Here are your Supernatural hosts, Patricia Baker and Becky Andreasen. Supernatural Girls.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting episode of Supernatural Girls. I am your host, Patricia Baker, and I'm echoing. I can't believe it.
Oh, no.
Oh, hi, no. Becky.
Hi, I'm back, and I brought the echo. Sorry.
No problem.
I'll be right back.
Give us a call. Give us a call right back, and we'll be echo-free, I hope.
Okay.
So, everybody, we have a fabulous show for you tonight. Our guest is Dr. Chris H. Hardy, and she is the author of an incredible book called DNA of the Gods, The Anunnaki, Creation of Eve, and the Alien Battle for Humanity. Now, Becky and I have read the book. It is tremendous. It's an excellent book. I couldn't put it down today. It was just something that I highly recommend for everybody, because Dr. Hardy has done a fantastic job in explaining things that are very difficult to explain. So I really hope that you'll all pick up a copy of it. The book is available on Amazon.com, and it is called DNA of the Gods, The Anunnaki Creation of Eve, and the Alien Battle for Humanity. Now let me see if Becky's back on. Becky, are you back
yes.
on with us?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Patricia. Hi, everyone. I'm happy to be back.
Oh, you sound good now. Everybody's echo-free. That's great. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness.
We had a scare with you last week, my dear, and it's so good that you're feeling so much better.
Yes,
and you're
yes.
back on the air. My goodness, it didn't take you long to recover.
No, it won't. And I couldn't wait to get back. And I mean, I'm so excited about our guest tonight, too, and the book was just absolutely fabulous, just fabulous. I loved it. I mean, I'm going to read it two or three more times. I was so excited with it.
It's great. I know. She did an incredible job, because you and I both read about the Anunnaki in the past, and we've actually have had guests on talking about it, but Dr. Hardy's book is remarkably well written, and I got it. You know, it's like she was taking us through the history and all of the different people who were fighting and had bad tempers.
I know.
So fascinating. So we're going to bring Dr. Hardy on in just a few minutes. And again, I'm so glad you're back, Becky, and I'm so glad you're
thank
feeling
you.
Better. You were greatly
thank
missed
you.
Last week. Greatly
oh,
missed.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your prayers. I appreciated them very much.
Well, that was great. I know a lot of people reached out to you and sent healing energy, and I know it all makes a
yes.
difference. So
it sure does.
Great.
Sure
that's
does.
Yes. And also have an announcement for everybody. I have a new book out on Kindle called Dream Calm, and that's spelled C-O-M-M. And it's very inexpensive. It's only $3.99. It is a handbook on dreaming for personal power. And you can read it pretty quickly. It's a small book, but it gives you all the high points, everything you need to know to become an expert at dreaming for personal power. So take a look at it, and please, if you order it, let me know how you like it. I would love to hear back from people who are using DreamCom in their everyday life and their every night life. So anyways,
wonderful.
You will find, yeah, thank you. You will find the book on SupernaturalGirlsWithAZ.com. And please go ahead and sign up for our newsletter if you haven't done that already, so that we can keep you informed of all the latest paranormal news and all of the latest things that we're going to be doing, because we always have exciting guests. So Anyway,
yes,
it's a fun thing to get that newsletter every week and see what's going on. So let's talk about Dr. Hardy. She holds a doctorate in ethnopsychology, a cognitive scientist and former researcher at Princeton's Psychophysical Research Laboratory. She has spent many years investigating non-local consciousness through systems theory and her own semantic field theory, the author of many research papers and published books, including The Sacred Network. Dr. Hardy lives in France, and she is calling in tonight, and she's here with us, and we're very excited to have her here, and I'm bringing her live on the air. Hi, Dr. Hardy.
Yes, hi. I'm so happy to be with you. I mean, I like very much your show, and I'm very happy.
Well, we are too. And
unfortunately,
I'm echoing again.
And I hear you echoing.
And now you're echoing.
No, I'm hearing.
What we may have to do, Dr. Hardy, is have you hang up and call back in. Sometimes when you're calling in from a foreign country, we have to adjust this around a little bit to make sure we get a clear line.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, and Becky and I will chat in the meantime until you come back on.
Okay.
Wow, that's hard tonight, huh?
Oh, I know. Well, you know, this can happen. I mean, she's kind enough to call us. It's the middle of the night for her in France.
I know.
And
they're,
like, 6-7 hours ahead of us. So God bless her for calling in. And then we get this echo. But that can happen on phone lines, as we know all too well.
Yes, we do.
Goodness.
And it's going to be so exciting to hear everything about her book. And, it's just this was so wonderful to follow step by step. I was so amazed, and I learned some new things or understood even more, you know, from Sitchin's books and, you know, what she was explaining. I just loved it.
Dr. Hardy.
I'm here again. Yes.
Okay.
So I'm back. Is it okay
and
now?
I don't hear an echo.
I don't hear an echo either.
So we're clear
okay,
to go.
Perfect.
So.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. And as you heard us talking about how much we love your book, it was just fantastic. So please start at the beginning. How did you get interested in this subject?
It has been a long path. I was starting to have very strong phenomena in meditation. I started meditating when I was 18, and I awoke at that time, and I started to be able to see a very strange light. All kind of beings that were also on different dimensions. I was not interacting with them at that time, but I had also very strong experiences in a high state of consciousness, and I was meditating very, very regularly, not at specific hours, but I was following my path, and I was feeling very strongly into a path of awakening. And meanwhile, of course, I was doing my studies, and that took me to a Bachelor of Art in Sociology and then Ethnology, Cultural Anthropology. And then I left for India to further my own inner path. And then I studied, I learned by listening to meeting and listening to absolutely fantastic people, Sufi master on my way, and then ascetics and many wise people. And then that started about 10 years of, at the same time, travels in different countries, in many countries, including Africa, Middle East, Far East. And basically I came back to studying and to science through dreams that came and showed me that I was going to meet scientists and to get back in science. And at that point, everything started opening very quickly. And indeed, I had done a mastery in ethnology, same thing. And then I wanted to do a doctoral thesis, and I started doing a book of interviews of scientists of the new paradigm. And it went very, very quickly, like after the dreams, like maybe a year after, I was writing a book with a biologist on a vibratory theory of the self. And then the year after that, I was already in the state preparing my doctorate at this PRL lab in Princeton. So it went very, very quickly. And that started another cycle of working where I started to, after my thesis, I started to develop my own theory of non-local consciousness. But to make it short and more to the point, what happened is that I started leaving myself all kind of psi and also spiritual phenomena and high state of consciousness, states of oneness, of fusion with nature, with the environment. I could see, for example, and speak to the nature spirit. And what happened after these experiences that were continuous, of course, but what happened is that I always wanted to explain them through a theory that would take those phenomena into account. I wanted to elaborate a theory that would be able to explain high states of consciousness like the samadhi, the state of unity, and also the presence of consciousnesses in trees, in mountains that I was experiencing all the time. So that's what took me. And then how do I get to Sumer is by reading Sitchin. And I had an incredible insight, or maybe a series of insights by reading Sitchin, and I understood that there was something there that I had to really dive into. And also,
a
dream.
Chris, was he the first to bring forth the Anunnaki history? Was he the first one to do that?
Oh, no, of course not. I believe Sitchin did very good work on that. But I must say that I went maybe a little further in some specific domains. And one was the study and the analysis of the Book of Genesis and some part of the Book of Genesis, like the Garden of Eden. And because I had then the background information from the Sumerian civilization, and there were so many, many similarities, and at the same time, dissimilarities. And of course, as a woman, you know, it's evident that the root of all our history through the patriarchal era, I mean, we are talking about 3,000 years in which women have been kind of put under the yoke, and we are just really fully taking our own dimension, you know.
Well, yes,
our freedom.
And I wanted to get up and I wanted to stand up and cheer when I read that part in your book.
Yes.
You know, when you were talking about this and how women have been under this, and you put it very diplomatically, under this yoke for so many years. But you know what? You are a pioneer, and you're somebody who is pointing this out and also giving the history of how this got started. And a lot of this misinterpretation that was actually disinformation on purpose so that religions could take ownership, et cetera. And I'm going to let you talk about that. But really, I was so thrilled to see you bringing this to the light. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much. It's very nice for me to have some feedback, you know, because it has been this work has been basically a work totally by myself and without any possibility to confide even to somebody. And so it's very nice to get some feedback.
Well, I know our audience is going to have to run out and buy your book because it's remarkable. And you are also, in the book, bringing the best of science and intuition and psi phenomenon together all at once. Because I could, and I know, Becky, you could too, really feel how your intuition was just driving this book forward. And when Becky and I read it, I mean, we really felt, Chris, that we were hearing words from you on many different levels.
Oh, very nice. Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, the thing is that it's evident that I had, through my theory, because this theory is showing, of course, that there is an energy, a spiritual energy in the universe and pervading the universe. And this, of course, is the highest or the core. You know, it's the same. I mean, what is outside is also what is above is below. But
right.
It's like this energy of which I call SIG energy, like semantic energy. It's energy of consciousness, and this energy of consciousness is, in my opinion, pervading the cosmos, and at the same time, it is within each individual. And when we think, when we feel, when we send love to somebody, and we receive thoughts and love, and we are exchanging this type of energy, but modulated by our own energy field, our own semantic field. And so when we are in this kind of worldview, we can, of course, there is this grand and holistic picture at the level of the universe. But if you apply this to for example, the understanding of a text, it allows me, for example, to feel when I read a text that has been written by two authors, I'm perfectly able to feel which author has written this specific page and which person has suddenly added something.
So you can really determine
the
truth here, because there is a lot of disinformation, don't you think, Becky, in a lot of this stuff?
Yes,
so.
Yes I do. I think people have put their own thoughts or tried to explain it their own way, and it has made it a form of disinformation. And then deliberately, I think there's been things that have been put in there. Right, I do. And seeing how you showed all this, like from the beginning, even the step by steps, it was just beautiful. It was beautiful because you could understand it and really feel it and see it. It was, I was just so amazed by it. It was put beautifully.
Yes, you know, I must tell you that this book has not been practically corrected. I added a lot of references, and I I flesh it out a little more, but basically it came out in two time 1 month. And I even have half of the second volume in this two time 1 month period of writing. So it's like it was absolutely like, you know, I don't know if you know the book of by Carl Jung. It's called Answer to Job.
Yes.
And it has a text on studying the book of Job, and the second part is on Revelation, the book of Revelation. And it's absolutely magistral book. And he said in his autobiography that the book came to him like a flow, you know, like a he could not stop it. He wrote it in something like 2 or 3 weeks or so. It was unbelievable. And starting with an incredible paranormal phenomena of where he saw entities from the, you know, from the other side, that were the dead people, and he had his house full of spirits. And then after this very beautiful strong work, the sermon to the dead, then he went into this book on Job. Very beautiful.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, a lot of times, Chris, when Becky and I have people on the show, people from the other side show up, and I have to tell you that there are three beings that are here with me now, and they are giving you the thumbs up. They are saying that your work is the closest thing they've ever seen to the absolute truth, and that you should absolutely pursue your theory, because your theory is right on the money. So take that as a vote of confidence from the people that visit us from the other side. And that's a pretty strong vote of confidence, in my opinion.
Excuse me, are you Becky talking or Patricia?
Patricia.
I am Patricia.
Yeah,
no,
and I am Becky.
The person who just said that now.
Patricia.
Are you Becky or Patricia?
Patricia.
Okay. Patricia, I must answer to that I am, even if my work in life, I understand it as being a bridge between the left brain and the right brain, I am able to discuss and dialogue with people, and especially scientists who have been dead since a long time, but who are absolutely alive the other side. So, thank you for what you said. It's very nice. I have also this capacity.
It's nice to know because, again, as I said, when Becky and I were reading your book, we were like, she's talking to us from so many different places. And so no wonder that you have this talent with connecting with people on the other side, because that's what we were picking up on when we were reading the book. So now you've given us all the confirmation of that. Very exciting. Very exciting work that you're doing, and I mean, you're a real trailblazer in this. You really are. But let me ask a question, because I was really intrigued. Now, first of all, your book is extremely well written, and it places, it's kind of comical the way that you portray these Anunnakis, that they were, some of them had bad tempers, and they were power hungry. And they had all the same faults that humans have, but in a big way, very exaggerated way. And I was wondering if you could talk to our audience about that, because I really enjoyed reading how imperfect they were.
Yes, the real truth,
well,
you know.
It's very important to connect the dots about that, you know, because how can I say that? Maybe what comes to my mouth is that it's like as if we had been screwed up, you know, in the fact that we had a family of God, of royals, because I must say, I must confess that having studied this in great depth and with all the using all my capacities of rational intelligence and intuition, I truly believe that the history we have in the tablets, in the Sumerian tablets, and they are not only in Sumerian language, they are in six or seven different languages from the whole Middle Eastern, especially Mesopotamia. It's like you can patch up a certain text from a part of it will be in Assyrian language, the other part will be Old Sumerian. You will find another piece in Akkadian or Babylonian language, and they are very truthful. And so you are able to make up, to put back the puzzle of one text, for example. So that gives how strong the historical data can be on this text. And also you have the scribe saying at the beginning, this is only a copy of an older Sumerian text. And even if he's writing in Akkadian or whatever, he's keeping the Sumerian names. So all this shows an incredible talentous civilization who wanted to have texts that were very protected on the river, you know?
Right.
Sorry.
But some of them, you had two camps here. You had one camp that wanted to control the people that were created, that was us, and use them as slaves and then dispose of them. And then you had another camp that wanted to see humans continue along in an evolutionary path that would be closer to the Anunnaki. And it seems like from what you were saying, and please correct me if I'm mistaken, but it appears that this war, this battle is still going on.
I would not say so, but let me broach the big picture maybe quickly, if I can make it quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
A little lengthy. The big picture is that basically you have a family of royals, okay? They come from another planet, a nomad planet, and this nomad planet has been attracted into our solar system, and now it is orbiting our sun with a very, very long elliptical orbit of 3,600 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And some of them come to Earth, especially the head scientist, and so this other planet is called Nibiru, the first planet, and the king of Nibiru is called Anu, okay? And then his son, who is the head scientist on Nibiru, comes to Earth and to get some gold to patch up their own atmosphere, ozone layer and all that. And then very quickly afterwards, his half-sister, Ninma, who is the head scientist of life sciences, all life sciences, is coming because they want to start living on Earth because there is gold and they need the gold for their atmosphere. And Ninma is absolutely needed because she's the one to bring the seeds to plant to start the agriculture. She's the one to bring the sheep and the domestic animals. She's the one to be able to make homegrown elixir of immortality, and they need it to keep being quasi-immortals. And basically, so they start working. And then at one point, Anu has, from his wife, because Enki was the son of his concubine, but the firstborn, and then Enki has from his wife, who was a half-sister, they were always very often married with half-sisters, a new son, a son called Enlil. And Enlil now comes to Earth and is given he becomes the commander of Earth because he is a legal heir. He passed over Enki. So at one point there is we have two brothers that are enemies and contenders, you know. So one is Enlil, but he's He has the legal title of King of Earth and Heaven, because Heaven through Anu, Heaven being Nibiru. And Enki was Lord of Earth, Enki, and himself is again left to take care of the gold and all the engineering, all the scientific work. Ninma comes, and I said what she was doing, but then at one point, the Nibirians that are working on Earth revolt because they don't want to do so much work in the mines, in the gold mine, in
yeah,
whatever.
That's hard work. That's hard labor.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so they revolt, and now the Assembly of the Gods is getting together, and they vote on the suggestion of Enki, they vote to create a new species that is going to be a hybrid between their own genome and a hominid that they have seen, that Enki has seen, and they want to create workers. So
now, the hominid
you're
talking about, is that a Cro-Magnon man? Is that an ape? What was that?
I believe it was Homo erectus.
Okay.
Because, yes, Homo erectus was living on Earth since 1.9 million years without having any kind of mutation. He was absolutely stable, unmoving, unmutating. And suddenly, 400,000 years ago, he started slowly mutating, and he finished his its mutation around 200,000 years ago. And that's where its mutation into the Homo sapiens, which then would mutate until we reach the Homo sapiens sapiens.
Wow.
Homo sapiens is a modern man, okay? Sapiens sapiens is a modern man.
Right.
So the interesting point is that the tablets, in the tablets you have a datation that is based on the year of Anu, so year of 3,600 solar our solar system year, okay? And basically, the Sitchin was able to date the birth of Adamu, I mean the creation, the genetic engineering of Adamu by Ninma and Enki around 300,000 years ago. So this is falling exactly because Adamu was not the first trial. They tried to bring out a man, a human being, earthling human being, several times, and it was unsuccessful. So that took an incredible time because they were not in the same time frame, you understand, of course.
Right. And they had much longer lifespans too, didn't they? Some of them were considered immortal.
But, Enki came, according to their datation with the Shars, Enki came 445,000 years ago on Earth, and he was already an adult.
Wow.
And he had, arrived on Earth, he had all the sons and daughters.
This is so fascinating. You know what? Let's take a short commercial break, Chris, and
yes.
We will
okay.
Give you a chance to catch your breath, get a glass of water, whatever you need, and we're going to go to a short commercial break, and then we're going to come back. There's so much to talk about. Everybody stay tuned. We will be right back.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. It's time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Bonjour, this is Véronique Raskin, founder of the Organic One Company. As one of the pioneers of the Organic One movement, since 1980, I have brought you the very best and most authentic organic wines directly to your table. I work with small family estates who grow certified organic grapes and produce exceptional wines. You can purchase our wines individually from our website at theorganicwinecompany.com or join one of our wine clubs. Our organic wines are perfect for you and for your family as gifts for friends and relatives, and they are simply spectacular for the holidays. Visit us at theorganicwinecompany.com to enjoy the very best organic wines conveniently delivered to your door. I am Véronique Raskin, passionate about my mission. I offer to you vegan, organic, and biodynamic wines, wines made by people of the heart, wines with a heart. Au revoir. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE.
Are you ready for a new experience of freedom and powerful connection? Would you like a positive, effortless change in your life? Then come to CosmicFusion.com, where we offer the most advanced energy clearing and expansion techniques in the world, with a quantum vortex energy to activate your divine blueprint and life's purpose. When your soul leads the way with cosmic fusion and quantum vortex energy, you can break clear of past difficulties and blocks with the power of the source. With cosmic fusion, the source energy does the work for you. It's easy and effortless. Listen to our free meditation right from our cosmic fusion website, the Cosmic Code Meditation. Sign up for one of our interactive webinars today. Come to Cosmic Fusion. www.kosmicfusion.com to experience an effortless awakening and transformation. Are you ready for an upgrade? Are you ready for a new experience of living in the fifth dimensional magic and powerful connection? Then visit cosmicfusion.com today. cosmicfusion.com.
Speaking with author Chris H. Hardy, Ph.D., and she is the author of DNA of the Gods, The Anunnaki, Creation of Eve, and The Alien Battle for Humanity. So right before the break, we were talking about, my question was, is there still a battle for humanity? And you said, not really. So have they kind of just gone away and we're kind of left to deal with what they did? What is this?
My impression is that there was a huge catastrophe at one point. I mean, they, from the side of Enlil, he wanted us to be only workers and slaves, as you yourself has made a resume. And in fact, on the side of our creator gods, there are three of them. There are Ninma, the first one, the genetic engineering person, and Enki, who was working with her, and also a son of Enki, called Ningish Zida in the tablets, and that we know as Thot and Hermes in Greece. Voilà, Thoth in Egypt and Hermes in Greece. So they were the three creator gods that really did the genetic engineering on four different steps. They evolved, they kept evolving the genome of the new mankind.
And, so they were the,
on the side,
Trinity.
Mm. Yes,
the Trinity.
It's, interestingly, yes. But, with a woman. Eh?
Yes,
yeah.
Father, Son, and Mother, Holy Spirit.
A sound,
yes.
Natural Trinity. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then on the other side, you had, I have the impression that Enki and Ninma were kind of a little pushing, how to say that, they were a little tricking the assembly of the god into creating this new species at their image with their own genome. And the other side, the argument that brought them to vote positively was the fact that they were going to create workers. So from the side of the assembly of the gods, directed by Anu and Enlil, what they wanted and what they thought they were going to create were workers, slave workers. From the side of Ninma and Enki, what they wanted is an intelligent being, an intelligent species that could maybe take the lead of once their own civilization was going to be over, because I believe that they understood that there could be a second catastrophe of huge cosmic proportion, and that could erase their original planet, and maybe Earth was, and humanity was then the civilization of intelligent beings that would keep the flame of consciousness, you know, on ahead. So
wow.
there was this constant infighting between on the side, not exactly Anu, sometimes he's a little far away, and more so as time passes. But on the side of Enlil and his own family, they were totally against any move that Ninma and Enki did in order to upgrade another time the human Earthborn humans.
Well, they had
and they got
foresight.
Pretty nasty about it too, didn't they? They were.
Yeah.
I mean, there was quite a tiff going
yeah,
on. It
so
got
nasty.
Pretty violent.
Yes, yes, so nasty that. We come to such incredible extremes that Enlil, at one point, when humanity has developed so much that, you know, at the same time they have so many servants, and he tries three times, on three different periods of times, he tries to erase humanity, to literally take it out of the face of the earth. And the first time is through a biological agent, you know, pandemia. And the second time is through starvation. And he has kept the grain and all food, you know, for them, and maybe the few servants that are helping them in their temples. And meanwhile, he's starving to death the whole human population on this part of the world.
That's terrible,
and
my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
cool.
Enki, yeah, and that was at the time of Noah. Noah, who is called Upnatishnishmim in the tablet. Sorry. And in fact, I mean, the exceedingly wise. And Yuzudra also, he has two names, different languages, you know. And so Noah comes to the temple of Enki, and he's always there because he's a disciple of Enki. And he's also a blood son of Enki. And Yuzu.com to come to Enki, and he says, please, please, Enki, please, we are dying from the dire anger of the gods. Please help us. And Enki, of course, does something. He creates the first revolt of the human being, the earthling, against the god. And he puts out such an incredible, funny revolt that now they are not going to go to the temple to pray and to serve the god. and
so that would be a big revolt. They're not going to go
furious.
To the temple and pray.
It's so funny. It's like
he's smart.
And Enlil understands that Enki has given some food, and so he calls an assembly of the god, and they are all there. And Enlil is accusing Enki of having given some food to the human beings, while he had decreed that they were going to be starved to death. And Enki answers, "Are you asking me to kill my own people?" I mean, the tablets, they are absolutely fabulous.
Enlil was asking him to kill his own people, right? That's what he wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
He was nasty.
So, it was absolutely nasty. And then, as he has not gotten what he wanted, which was to erase humanity, he decides, they know that now there is a deluge coming because all kind of signs, you know, they always thought that there could be some catastrophe at one point, like the first time the planet was attracted in our solar system, they had a huge collision of planets, and that's a little too complex to talk, but that's how Earth also was formed, but that's another time. And now they know that this time Nibiru is going to pass too near our Earth, and it will create an enormous tsunami, which is going to be what we call the deluge. And so is again convening an assembly of the gods, and Anu is there, and his wife, and he's forcing the gods, all the assembled gods, which is a royal family, so to speak, and he's forcing them not to reveal to the human beings that there is going to be a huge, enormous wave that is going to erase the whole of civilization on Earth. And he's telling the Anunnaki that they have to either go back to Nibiru or orbit in their spaceship, in their spacecraft, and in their plane around Earth until the end of the deluge. And you know that the deluge was about 3 months.
Wow,
and so
they watch.
I mean, the texts are heartbreaking, you know, because you see Inanna, you see Ninma. They are in their planes, and they are seeing all life being on all their creation, and Ninma is crying, and she says, my created, and she cries and cries, and they don't eat, and they have no food, and it's incredible. And Inanna is absolutely earth, she's a very complex person, and she's totally upset with herself that she has given her okay at the assembly of the god. And what happened is that Enki was forced by his brother to swear that he would not give the information. And then he finds a trick to give the information to Noah, to Zuzudra. And he's talking to his hut, you know, his reed hut. And he says, reed hut, listen to me. The assembly of the gods have decreed the doom for humanity, a huge catastrophe, and then he gives him, information how to build a submersible. So we see that in Elil, in the tablet, we see things absolutely clearly, you know. Mm-hmm. And with traits of character that are so consistent from one text to the other, you know. Enlil is definitely Enlil. Of course, you have some hymn praise and all that, but generally speaking, you have something that is so coherent, so sensitive also, that cannot miss the truth. Mm.
And you're seeing, like you said, their personalities really do get carried over from one writing to another, and they all have a mission, and they are they're fighting with each other over how the mission's going to unfold. So, again, I was really taken with the descriptions that you gave about their tempers, their fighting. These were supposedly gods, but they were acting like naughty children.
Yes. Well, as a psychologist, when I studied in depth the part of the scripture, the Book of Genesis, which is dealing with the sin and the fall, part of Genesis, and I was able to sort out a level of the text that is purely what I call informational framework, and another part of the text that was definitely like added up later or edited, you know, as Sitchin would put it, and this other level, I called it a moralistic framework. And it was incredible because everything basically in the informational framework, the sentences, the group of words, were exactly the story as we are told in the Sumerian tablets. And the moralistic framework was something that was totally alien to the to the Sumerian civilization. For example,
That would make sense because they really didn't act like they had many morals. They just were power hungry and angry people whose tempers got out of control quite easily, and they were all vying, to have dominion over these humans, whether they be enlightened humans or whether they be slave workers. They wanted dominion over us.
Yes, and one something extremely grave, in my opinion, in terms of the moral sense that we have developed, is the fact that you have to understand that each person in the royal family would take a city, would create his or her own city, and a temple inside this city. It's a little more complex, but grosso modo, it's like this. And the people, the earthlings that were living around this temple and working to build the temple in the first place, to build the irrigation canals and everything, and to serve the gods and everything. So the earthlings that were around this temple, in this city that was being created, and then, of course, I mean, it's like they don't move, and we go like generation, and suddenly you have a whole city of earthlings around one temple. Hmm. And these earthlings were, by definition, as the followers of this god or this goddess. You understand? They were the Lord. They were... And then it so happens that their fighting, their struggle in between them becomes so nasty, so bitter, that sometimes when they want to kill another one of the royal family, they kill the population of followers.
Yeah, so they didn't go after the other royal. They went after all of the people underneath them that they were in charge of. They wiped out all of those people. That's pretty mean. I mean, these people, the Anunnaki, I have to say this, they're kind of scary in their lack of internal moral compass. They didn't have one. It was just all for the quest of power.
Yes, well, I found out something even more surprising, is that they have no self-reflexive ability. They are absolutely unable on the side of the Enlilit, all the family side of Enlil, they have absolutely no capacity to reflect on their own action. And they keep repeating the mistake, and they just want what they have decided, and whatever is the stupidity that is implied by. For example, at the time, they only would have erased the wall of humanity through the deluge by not by themselves, all the Anunnaki getting safe, you know, in safe haven, wherever. And all the humans and animals and plants being killed, you know, through this deluge. I mean, he had absolutely no idea that he would not have followers anymore. He would not have people to serve him, to cook. He would not have food.
So he was pretty short-sighted. But, you know, what you're describing, Chris, it sounds like the Anunnaki did not have a conscience.
Yeah, they had, because, we have talked a lot about the negative aspect until now, but they have extremely strong positive aspect also. They are extremely artistic, they create a magnificent temple, they have a knowledge of geometry, architecture. They were, Enki was the one, as a head scientist, he was the one to divide the sky, you know, into 360 degrees, and to elaborate the system with 12 constellations, and then to name the constellation. He was the one to start the irrigation works. He was the one to raise the land of Egypt. You know, Egypt was called raised land.
Ptah,
he was a Ptah in Egypt. He started the whole Egyptian civilization. And I found out something absolutely incredible, is that the first initiatic lines were started in Sumer by Enki and Ninmah. So basically, you have to distinguish that between two families, two parts of the same family, but one the Enlilit, they always want to keep humanity as slaves. They don't want to give them education, knowledge, science, nothing. And on the side of Ninmah and Enki, they want all the time to bring humanity higher, to upgrade our DNA, to teach. They wanted to reach the civilized man, you know, to create a civilized man. They teach all the time, every new generation, like they taught Adamu and Adapa, they taught him astronomy, they take him to the moon, to Mars, to show him this, they take him to Nibiru, he's finally going to get the elixir of immortality. And Eve also, we have depiction of Eve as on a par with Enki, sitting and discussing with the tree of knowing, the tree representing the genome in the middle of them, and each one presenting his hand like, you know, you have a passage of energy from one hand going to the Tree of Knowing, but basically in front of Enki, also presenting his hand toward her, you know.
And well, what the, you see, beautiful. Bring up a question that I've had for a long, long time about the Adam and Eve story, because I always felt it was somehow corrupted. It didn't seem to make any sense to me about the temptation and, you know, that the woman did the apple. Could you tell us what you think really occurred?
Yes. The story is very clear in the Sumerian tablet. We are lacking a book in the Sumerian tablets, which is often referred to, and it was called The Generation of Adapa. And in the scripture, in Genesis, this book is also referred to as The Generations of Adam. And this book would have explained everything, what happened exactly in the Garden of Eden. So basically, Eden is the name of Sumer. It's Edin in Sumerian. And it's Sumer is Mesopotamia between Tigris and Euphrates. So what happened in the Garden of Eden is that Enki and Ninma had understood that in order to have a fully civilized man or woman, human, they needed to have an Anunnaki goddess carry on the fetus, you know, on giving birth and then raising the child as if it was an Anunnaki child. So they do that. The first Adamu is it's Ninki, the wife of Enki, who is giving birth. And then it's Ninma carrying Tiamat Eve. And so basically you have the two kids, the first couple in the Garden of Eden, they are raised by in between Enki, Ninma, Ninki, in magnificent places in the middle of nature, because Enki was a lover of nature. And then they are commanded to come to Sumer by Enlil, who wants to show them around, because the land of creation was in Africa, in Eastern Africa, in Zimbabwe. So now Enlil wants to see the great creation, and they have to go to Sumer. So I believe they did some kind of tractation that Enlil was going to build a garden next to the property of Enki near the Persian Gulf, and that was the famous garden. And now he's going to have the two kids, but as soon as they get there, he's commanding them to tend the garden, not to touch the tree of immortality, the tree of knowing. And so basically you see Enki's emblem was the serpent. When Enki is visiting them, for the scriptures, it has been changed into now is the snake in a negative way, but his symbol, Enki's symbol, and then Hermes' symbol, and is the Caduceus. It's a sort of Caduceus. It's a blueprint of the Caduceus of Hermes in Greece. Mm-hmm. And so the serpent was the initiator, the keeper of knowledge. And on the tablet is shown as, it's written in Sumerian, keeper of secrets, or a god of the deep mind, but keeper of secrets. And we have a depiction where we see Tiamat with Eve, who was in the garden. They receive a new upgrading by Hermes. and they did this, Hermes did the operation on the adult, on the adolescent bodies, taking some DNA from the bones marrow of Enki and Ninma. So they were, the four of them, put into hypnosis or unconsciousness, and then he did the extraction of the bone marrow from Ninma, put put it into the bone marrow of a graft, you know.
So this would be considered not this big fall from grace, but it would be considered another upgrade in consciousness.
In the DNA.
It is. Yeah, that was the point. The point was double. The first one was to give them the ability to procreate, but more than that, and to have intercourse, to have sexual intercourse. But more than that, it was an upgrade to self-consciousness.
So they perceived that as a good thing, not a bad thing.
No, it was a fabulous thing. But it was keeping in line all the time with Enki, Ninma, and Hermes' wish and will to all the time upgrade human beings so that they may become extremely wise, exceedingly wise, like finally Noah will get to this point. And
wow.
So what happened is that they did that in this Edin property of Enlil. And suddenly Enlil arrives one day and he looks for Adam because he was talking only to Adam. And finally he falls on them and he's seeing that in the tablets, he's seeing that Tiamat has not only made herself some clothing, some loincloths, but also she has made a makeshift table. And this is very interesting because we don't have the makeshift table, which is like a perfectly geometrical grid. So you have to imagine those two adolescent kids, you know, and they have been upgraded to self-consciousness. They are now going to be able to have intercourse, or maybe they just had on to procreate. And Enlil suddenly arrives and understands instantly that Enki again has done something to upgrade the human beings. You understand?
Yeah,
because
so he must have been curious.
Voilà. So, of course, he becomes totally furious and rage, you know. And then he understands that they have eaten the fruit of the tree of knowing, because it's very strange, those trees, but they are conscious beings, they are divine beings, they are gods, three gods, the tree of knowing and the tree of immortality. They are in the garden of Anu, and now Enlil is putting them in the garden where he's going to bring Eve and Adam. And it's related to the fact that they ate this fruit that was somehow, in a mysterious way, going to shift their consciousness also. Mm. And it's not only, it's too present. You have this tree of knowing exactly represented like the DNA. It's you have representation of the DNA with the two snakes, with the caduceus. It's too clear a symbol to. It's talking. It's absolutely clear that there was something mysterious in that. But
well,
the tree of immortality they have not taken. So,
yeah, what you're describing, Chris, is something that makes more sense to me. About, again, it falls right in line with the war they were both having over human consciousness or slaves. And it just, instead of the fairy tale we were told, and also what you mentioned is the way that women became less than right from the very beginning. That's how this was misinterpreted, so that women were always less than a man. And you're saying, again, absolutely, from your research and all the history you brought forward, that certainly was not the case. So let's take another short commercial break. I know, Becky,
yes,
you've got questions about Ishtar.
Yes,
I know
I
you're
do.
Dying to ask. So stay tuned, everybody. It's a fascinating discussion, and we will be right back.
This is Veronique Raskin, founder of the Organic One Company. As one of the pioneers of the Organic One movement, since 1980, I have brought you the very best and most authentic organic wines directly to your table. I work with small family estates who grow certified organic grapes and produce exceptional wines. You can purchase our wines individually from our website at theorganicwinecompany.com or join one of our wine clubs. Our organic wines are perfect for you and for your family as gifts for friends and relatives, and they are simply spectacular for the holidays. Visit us at theorganicwinecompany.com to enjoy the very best organic wines conveniently delivered to your door. I am Veronique Raskin, passionate about my mission. I offer to you vegan, organic, and biodynamic wines, wines made by people of the heart, wines with a heart. Au revoir. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE.
Are you ready for a new experience of freedom and powerful connection? Would you like a positive, effortless change in your life? Then come to CosmicFusion.com, where we offer the most advanced energy clearing and expansion techniques in the world, with a quantum vortex energy to activate your divine blueprint and life's purpose. When your soul leads the way with cosmic fusion and quantum vortex energy, you can break clear of past difficulties and blocks with the power of the source. With cosmic fusion, the source energy does the work for you. It's easy and effortless. Listen to our free meditation right from our cosmic fusion website, the Cosmic Code Meditation. Sign up for one of our interactive webinars today. Come to Cosmic Fusion. www.kosmicfusion.com to experience an effortless awakening and transformation. Are you ready for an upgrade? Are you ready for a new experience of living in the fifth dimensional magic and powerful connection? Then visit cosmicfusion.com today. cosmicfusion.com.
Your property tax bill. Have you seen it lately? It's frightening. Your property taxes are going up while your home value is going down. Time to fight back and win. For the real truth about the property tax system, get attorney Pat Quintilian's book, Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Attorney Quintilian answers all your questions and gives you the facts you need to fight a property tax bill that is spiraling out of control. You'll also read about what happens to property owners who don't check their property records, only to find out too late they're taxed on square footage, fixtures, and even buildings that they don't own. Is this happening to you? Learn your rights. Buy attorney Pat Quintilian's book today. Are You Getting Screwed on Your Property Taxes? How to Find Out and How to Fix It. Available on Amazon.com.
Welcome back, everyone.
We are having a great discussion
with Chris H. Hardy,
PhD,
and she is the author of DNA
of
the Gods,
the Anunnaki Creation of Eve,
and the alien battle for humanity. And I'm hearing an echo again.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Chris, I'm going to have to ask you if you would please hang up and call right back in.
No problem.
Again, it's a problem with the line. So, Becky.
Yes.
Here we are again. Echo problem.
I can't wait. When she gets back, I want to ask about all these clones. I mean, we're just cloning for the past few years here, and they were cloning way back then. That was amazing, too.
Yes, yes. Well, please, go right ahead. You just take on over, and I'm going to sit back and listen.
Okay, and the Mies. Oh, my gosh, I've got to get to the Mies. Those are fascinating.
Got to find out about that. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Hi, Chris. Yes, I want to ask you about cloning.
Wait a second. Hang on 1 second. Let me just get the real Chris on the line. Hi, Chris.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
Okay, good. And we are echo-free. So Becky has about a million questions for you. So go
yes,
for
I
it,
do.
Becky.
Oh, my gosh. I wanted to ask about Nidma, who made replicas of the genomes and cloned. They were cloning after they went to... Tiamat and Adama went to the garden. She kept the genomes and made clones after clones after clones for the gold mines. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Because
now were they?
Remember
were they,
that they had a command. Hello.
Right.
You hear me?
Right.
Yes.
They had a command. They had a command from the Assembly of the Gods that Nidma was going to create this new species as workers. So basically, as soon as they have a successful human being, of course they are going to keep the donor, first the male, Adamu, and then the female, Tiamat, as donors. So those two are going to be honored. And they are not going to be put to work. But immediately, even at first with Adamu, she creates 7 clones. But they needed 7 Anunnaki goddesses to carry the fetus and to give birth and to raise them. And then as soon as she upgrades the genome, the DNA, and she comes up with Tiamat, immediately she creates 7 clones of Tiamat, 7 female clones, and the same with 7 Anunnaki goddesses. And so basically they kept creating clones 7 by 7, and these clones were going to be put to work in the gold mines. And then at one point, of course, Enlil, who has totally forgotten that they are trying to save their planet, their home planet, because they use the gold to spray ions in gold ions in the upper atmosphere. They had a terrible ozone layer problem, like we have, but certainly much worse. And so that's why they needed the gold in the first place. And so forgetting totally about his own planet, he wants the clones called Lulu, they were called Lulu, hybrid, and he wants them. And he goes to the South Africa where you have... Enki and all the clones working in the gold mines, and he mount a kind of military operation with his one of his sons, and they go and they abduct the workers and take them back to Sumer to work, and they are going to be put to work naked like slaves. You have a lot of depictions of them.
Wow. It sounds like Enlil had no insight to the future yet.
No, absolutely
Nidma,
no.
Yeah, Nidma and Enki did. They were trying to supply and ensure up the future, even for them there on Earth. Mm. And they're the two different families. Mm-hmm. That's what, when I was reading through everything, it sounded like one family didn't have the insight there and the other family absolutely did. And then the next fascinating thing, Mies, the sacred techno magical object, the Mies. That was fascinating.
I was reading
through that and I was picturing this type of biological, computerized, biological mixed pieces of jewelry or pieces of little thin pieces or crystal pieces that were put on clothing or upon the people's, you know, the goddesses or gods' bodies that would reenact to them. Is that something like what it was?
Yes, not only that, this also, we have, if I can give you some names, you will understand. For example, we have, don't forget that they have spacecraft, and each time that Nibiru is coming near to Earth, Anu and some new 50 new Anunnaki are coming to Earth to settle on Earth, and so they have in Enlil temple at one point you have one Anunnaki who was an orphan and is stealing, is trying to get his way into working into Enlil temple in Nippur, I mean the most sacred town of Sumer, where he's the commander of Earth. And at one point, Enlil goes somewhere, and his name was Zu, he steals a Mi that is called the Tablet of Destiny. And so I have a little piece of text here. As soon as Zu steals and removes the Tablet of Destiny, suspended were the divine formulas, the other Mies. The lighted brightness died out. Silence prevailed. In space, the Igigi were confounded. The Igigi are the astronauts. They have a space station. They have a space station on Mars. They have an orbital space station also. And the Igigi are the astronauts. They are the ones. They are also called Nephilim. The traduction in the scriptures. And they are the ones in heaven. Yes. So this is incredible because basically as soon as he takes this main piece, this it's like all the machinery there in the wall temple and especially this holy of holies, this room, then they don't have, nothing is working anymore. And in space, on the space station, the astronauts don't see anything anymore. They don't have the charts anymore. They don't see what's happening.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
So in the same temple of Nippur, you had, here are the names of the Mies. So that's how you can understand what they are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Here are the names of the Mies of the temple of Nippur that Zu have stolen. Okay,
right.
Here is one. A lifted eye which scans the land. A lifted beam which penetrates all. A vast net. In the temple is, quote, a fast-stepping bird whose grasp no one could escape. This is incredible. I mean, it's like also they talk about the Great Pyramid, and they talk to the Great Pyramid as if it was a divine being, you know, at least a conscious being.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they praised the Great Pyramid, and it was named Ekur, a house with a pointed roof. And they say, your dimensions are surpassing, you know. And they say that your... it's absolutely
like
beautiful.
Like a being. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, the dimension, the proportion between the height, you know, that it is reproducing the diameter of the Earth. They have some cosmic proportions, the pyramids.
Now,
yes.
You're saying in your book also, Chris, that the pyramids were kind of like a space connector. I mean, that they actually were like a control station.
Oh, definitely, yes. They were built for that. They had a whole complex of places that were used to monitor their space travels. And after the deluge, they have to rebuild them. And they have geometrical design, grand geometrical, global geometrical design, like rays, you know. And the pyramid, the Ekur, there was one in Nippur. And after the deluge, it is rebuilt in Giza, on the Giza plateau. And then they have the landing, what they call the landing place, was in Baalbek. And the control center for space was on the Sinai spaceport. The spaceport was on the Sinai, and the Ekur was the control center. So basically, what I told you about the temple in Nippur, what we saw, the lifted eye, the scan the land, the lifted beam, and all that. This is going to be now in the Great Pyramid. This is a new Ekur.
Wow.
So it's absolutely fabulous.
And it just gives a whole new meaning to what the pyramid was for, and it's so much more advanced than what anybody else has put forth. So it makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And was it... And could you tell the story
about
of
Anina? The pyramid? Mm-hmm. About the pyramid, I just wanted to input something. Is that you know that we believe that the Great Pyramid, I mean, conventional archaeology believes that it was the pharaoh Khufu who built the Great Pyramid because his name was found somewhere.
Right.
Saying that he had a dream, but he had a dream about rebuilding, not rebuilding, but making some new arrangement only. And there is a very old text, a Sumerian text called The Tales of the Magicians. In the Tales of the Magicians we found to Pharaoh Khufu, the magician answer, because the Pharaoh Khufu asked, where are the plants of the pyramid, of the Ekur, of the pyramid? And the magician is a very wise man, and he's the one to answer. So he answered, quote, I know not the information in the design, O king, but I know where the plants with numbers were hidden by Thoth.
Oh.
The guardian, Thoth is Ningizida, is Hermes. The guardian, his name in Sumerian means the guardian of the place of life. Okay, the magician, next sentence, quote, there is a box of whetstone in the sacred chamber called the chart room in Heliopolis, and the plants are in that box, in that chart room.
Oh, my
so
God.
Was that ever recovered, that box?
There was something else in further down in the text of the Tales of the Magicians. It was said that only a descendant of Khufu would be able to find this box of whetstone with the plans of the pyramid. But the plans mean the proportions, the cosmic proportions of the pyramid, you know, the all the work done lately by Anthony Waist and Robert Schausch and Robert Boval, and I mean the Orion, the pyramid would be, you know, stretching an energy beam toward Orion. All this is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
wow.
It really
and
is.
Nobody from the family of Khufu has found it yet, right?
Of the descendant of Khufu, we have not found this box.
Yes, that's right.
I mean,
wonder.
We don't know, but we don't think it has been.
Wow, that would be something for someone to find that box, and then they'd know that they're from the line of Khufu.
Yes,
wouldn't
and
it?
But, we
but
would finally have the plan.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I had this idea also. I had
wow.
This,
if you ever find the box, you let us know.
Yes.
No,
you
not better. Me. I'm not I'm not working
wow.
on the pyramid, but maybe somebody else. You know what they are doing now? They are they have a laser penetrating the earth like they had in Sumer. Let me tell you the name again. A lifted beam which penetrates all.
Oh, see?
Oh,
it's able
my
to
goodness.
Penetrate the earth. Okay?
Yes.
So that's what we have now. So
well,
they
wow.
have discovered with this specific
that's
laser.
That's what you were saying in
they
the book,
discovered.
Is that you're now, we're now approaching a similar technology to what the Anunnaki
yeah.
had. We're not quite there yet, but we're mm-hmm. on our way, it sounds like.
That's right.
Yes. And
yes.
What they have done in Egypt is that they have this laser and they are able to see what is underground, very deep, like 20, 30 meters, and they are able to make out what kind of stone, what kind, where there is a cavity, where there is a tunnel, and they have found out new pyramids that are covered by the by soil, and they have discovered all kinds of chambers and tunnels and everything. So we are going to discover things, especially since the ancient people controlling archaeology, and we were, the power, the shadow power that were keeping everything undercover, are now not there to control anymore. I mean, they have been a little pushed aside, and we are very happy with this. of
yes.
course.
Oh. I have a question about, I've heard that there's a huge pyramid in Alaska, and that the Anunnaki
in Alaska?
Is there. Yes, in Alaska. That the Anunnaki is there. Have you heard of that?
No.
Yes,
no, I have not heard either of Anunnaki being in Alaska. Only
uh-huh.
one time through a strange book I have not heard about a pyramid in Alaska. I will look. I
yes.
will look for this.
There's a covered huge that's been discovered in Alaska, huge pyramid
wow.
underground covered.
Oh.
And there's been many and many of people in Nome and I forget the other city, missing, just coming up missing, gone. And
okay.
there's been stories of the Anunnaki there.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I had a slight impression that one was also in the east. And I mean, it's absolutely fascinating the time we are living through, because it's like everything is coming out in full light, you know, under the spotlight.
Yeah.
It's, all the information is coming out. It's like so many of us are digging, you know, and diving into eras of knowledge that have been totally put under the carpet, you know, under seal, under levels and levels of secrecies. It's,
yes.
I'm so glad I cannot tell you that I can participate into that. It's
a
great, great pleasure.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great time to be alive for this, because I don't this kind of information would have been suppressed years ago. And so now we're all in this time where we can talk about this freely.
Maybe I would have been surprised.
Oh, yeah, you would have been. No question.
Yeah.
You would have been suppressed. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was very delighted to hear about the Eetu and the Nephilim. You know, for many years I was wondering, who are the Nephilim? I know they're guardians or watchers, but there's been many different, things spoken about guardians and watchers, different beings and different things. And the Igigi were the astronauts that were continually in orbit, had their space station on Mars, and they were the eye openings, always watching. They were the absolute watchers and the orbiters to watch everything. So when they came down to Earth to take women as wives, you know, because they see Marduk had wives and that and wanted to do
absolutely
the same. Yes. Mm-hmm. That really sealed it for me, understanding they are who the Nephilim, the fallen Nephilim were, because they were the ones that actually came down that weren't supposed to really come down. Their way station was on Mars, and they were to continually orbit and watch. That was their plot in life. And so when that happened, I realized.
Igigi in Sumerians means exactly those who observe and orbit. It's interesting.
Yes. I was fascinated with that. I finally found who the Nephilim were, who came down, the fallen. Yeah. That was
very
exciting.
It's very interesting that at one point, you have many, many references to the fact that at one point, either Enki or Hermes, Ningish Zida, or Marduk, they take the new the earthling one by one, you know, when they grow, when they become adult, and they take them to Mars and to the Moon and to show them to explain to them the astronomy. They take Adapa to Nibiru, and he will become immortal. It's incredible. I mean, you have so many, many references. At one point, you have explained that Enki took Marduk when he was younger, of course. He took Marduk to Mars, and he wanted to learn astronomy to him, and that's where he's learning. He's teaching him astronomy. And Marduk is kind of upset. He doesn't want to stay there. He prefers to be in Sumer and all this. And Enki forces him, you know, to stay and to learn and to learn astronomy. It's very, very interesting. I have the impression that it is exactly at that moment that Enki built a base on Mars. And maybe on the Moon, because they went also to the Moon.
Oh.
So my impression is that some of the runes, you know, that are on Mars and also on the Moon, some of them are from the Anunnaki. But we may discover more, because I said before that there is a veil. There is a lot of things in the Sumerian tablets, and especially when you are able to translate them with a new vision, with a new paradigm. But and you don't say, for example, Inanna flew like a bird. You say Inanna took her bird and flew, plane and flew, and flew too. Yes, but there is also a lot of things that are even steel veil from us in the Sumerian tablets. And I believe that notably that the fact that the universe is teeming with life, the fact that this absolutely certainly had met other intelligent civilization in the universe, and they were in communication with them, things like that, you know.
Right.
So there may be other types of alien. I'm sure there are other types of aliens that have been also on Earth, not only the Nibirians, but all kind of different races of aliens from different worlds.
Yes, now, I've got a question
that.
For you, Chris, from the chat room. Somebody
mm-hmm.
wants to know what or when do you think the Anunnaki or their descendants, the space people, whatever you want to call them, are going to make themselves known to us?
Ah. Well, of course, I don't know what are their plans. But if I understand that, I do believe that only one or two of them are still remaining. They have destroyed themselves when they nuke Palestine, and this is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to kill and erase Marduk and, of course, his followers, and this is the story of Lot. In the Sumerian paradigm, on va dire. And it's when they use nuclear weapons, they talk about seven awesome weapons, and first they destroy the spaceport, and then they destroy seven cities of the plane who were followers of Marduk. And just because they were, meanwhile, of course, Marduk left immediately and was not at all touched, and he went back to Sumer. But what happened is that they had no idea, because it was so long ago that they knew about these weapons, and Enki had hidden them, but they found out through his pilot, and they unearthed them and used them. And the winds went back to Sumer and erased all life in Sumer, apart from the city of Marduk, Babylon.
Mm.
So basically, they had totally forgotten what kind of energy and what kind of disastrous effect through contamination clouds and winds. And they saw those what they call evil winds arriving on Sumer, and they saw the destruction of all life. And only some of them were able to escape quickly enough. Some died, were terribly sick, and then died. And Enki came back, and Marduk were totally safe. Inanna, we know that she took her plane and left, but we don't know if she was poisoned and contaminated or not during this time. And so most of them they self-destroyed. It was totally suicidal.
Well, This is all so fascinating. Everybody needs to go out and get your book, DNA of the Gods. It's available on Amazon.com. And, Becky, I know you wanted to talk about Ishtar, so here's your chance.
Yes. Tell us about the rings and the rods and everything. I heard Ishtar ended up with, Inanna or Ishtar ended up with most all the Mi's.
Ah, the Mi's that Inanna kind of, she tricked Enki into giving her 90 Mi's.
Wow.
And Inanna is known as the goddess of love, but she must have been so incredibly beautiful. And Nobody could resist her. Neither mortal, neither hybrid, neither Anunnaki god, nor whatever her uncle or grandfather, whatever. She went one day to Enki's temple abode in Africa, and Enki received her with a magnificent dinner, and because Enki is a great womanizer, and of course he had wine, and they had beer, and so they start drinking, and Inanna is trying her best to push him to drink more and more. And at the end of the meal, she starts asking to see the Mies, because Enki had the most enormous collection of Mies, because he was creating them himself. You know, he was the engineer. And because they are kind of programs in a tiny device, they look like diamonds, you know. They are small. Oh. Like she could have a dozen in her hand. And she asked again, and please show me more and show me more. And then she, at the end of the meal, she took all the maize that Enki had shown her, and she departs with them. Mm. And now the next thing happened is that now she's the great queen, and she's the first among the gods. So as soon as she gets the Mies, she becomes the first among the gods. And she becomes the queen of Sumer and Akkad and the whole world, the queen of Earth. And she's taking the power from Enlil. It was called the Enlil ship. I mean, the power of the commander of Earth. And she becomes the commander of Earth
for a whole cycle.
Yes.
Wow, that is
so fascinating. These Mies gave her a tremendous amount of power, it sounds like.
Yes, but it's very strange. We cannot understand that, because we are confronted in Sumer with a kind of integral science, where a little computer chip, you know, with a program, a specific program to control the spaceport or to control the orbiting space station and all that. Of course, we understand it can be on the chip and it can send information on orders, even on commands. But what we don't understand is how this could give a person, something similar could give a person the power to rule, and that every other god is going to accept that she now is the one to have the power.
Mm.
Because she had not stolen them. She tricked Enki. You understand? Because they had an assembly of the god, and she said, no, I did not steal them. He gave them to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. It was hers.
Well, he kind of did. He was a little tipsy, but he did give them to her.
Yes. Wow. That is something. I was always interested also in the owl and the lions at the foot of Ishtar there. What were those symbolic of?
The lions surrounding the two entwined snakes.
Yeah, at the foot of Ishtar, there's owls and lions.
At the feet of her statue, you mean?
Yes, at her statue there that they have. She has she has the rod in the circle in her hand.
Inanna in her Lilith persona. Yes, she's like the goddess of the knowledge of the night, which was a magical knowledge, I believe. Eh? I think you would be agreeing with me, because you may know more than me.
Yes.
But you can see, d'abord, she's absolutely beautiful. She's peaceful. She's not the Lilith that we have made her become, like the horrendous sorcerer, you know, who is going to kill her followers and all that. She's not like that. Inanna was the goddess of the sacred marriage. She was not killing anybody. She would make her lovers rulers and kings of Sumer and Akkad. So when we see Lilith, she has the emblems of the gods. When you have one person, one of the gods of the royal, of course, first you have to be in the royal family. If not, you don't exist in Sumer. But if you are one of the royals and you access this Enlilship and you become the first among the gods, then I was able to decipher that you have two emblems. You have a rod and you have a circle, a torus, you know, like a ring.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the ring on the and the rod are the two emblems of the first among the gods at one point.
Oh.
Of the first ruler.
Wow.
And in this incredible statue of a bas-relief of Inanna as Lilith, and it's from Le Louvre Museum, and it's incredible to see in front of you like this. And what you have is that first she's totally naked, then she has two holes both sides of her feet. Then she's holding her arms like you can find this, you know, with the goddess or gods in Hinduism, for example. You would have those incredible mudra, you know, gesture of the hands, that are powerful gesture, and she's holding her two arms like Mut, you know, the goddess of the sky. Also sometimes you have Isis with this gesture. And she's holding in each hand one rod and one ring. So she has the utmost power. So to imagine that this sculpture would represent a sorcerer, a mean sorcerer killing her followers is absolutely, I mean, you have to be blind, you know, blind.
Yeah, I know.
Natural magic, we will call it.
Yes, that's right. That was beautiful. That I always wondered, you know, for sure, you know, the owls and the lions, the power, and I see the owls would be the night knowledge. I understand that. Yes, and she was a good goddess.
Mm-hmm. And of course, she's her character is very strange. Huh? She was also a warmonger. She made war like crazily. Mm-hmm. More and more as she was getting older. But she's also very attached, very, very intelligent and complex person. She's astounding. With Ninma, they are the most beautiful, feminine, most interesting feminine psyche and intelligence. You know, they are both genius people. But what's interesting is the fact that she was able to raise herself. She's the fourth generation after Anu, and she was able to raise herself at the level of being the first among the gods. It's incredible.
Yes,
absolutely
that
incredible.
Is incredible. Wow.
See, that's our potential, all of us women, right? This is what we can aspire to.
There you go.
Yes.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yes. 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 Exactly. Exactly. Well, it's...
Well,
go ahead.
We need feminine figures in the divine dimension, you know. The divine dimension is a cosmic dimension of cosmic energy of consciousness, and I don't see why it should have been grabbed by the masculine only figures, you know. It's beyond feminine, beyond masculine. And we absolutely need to be a humanity, both men and women, and we need to, each one of us, to be accomplish and fulfill and able to connect with the divine dimension. And for this, sometimes we need, it's not like we are going to be the devotees of Inanna. I mean, she's not the person we could be a devotee to. No, none of the Anunnaki. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, they could be maybe a friend, but not gods, you know. But at the same time, we need some role model in order to give us strength to move further the role models. And so this is my main, as a psychologist now I'm talking, I'm saying that this is absolutely, totally, not only unfair and unjust, but so crazily blind to have deprived humanity from feminine divine figures. It's like half of our psyche is put under the under the yoke and
yeah,
cannot
well,
express
keeps,
itself.
Right, and that keeps humanity as slavish.
Yeah, of
that's
course.
What it does. Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
We don't want to be that. We're given the gift to be free.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Of course.
Mm-hmm. Another huge question.
And not only to be free, but also, to be free is the key, but also to keep discovering and exploring the reality of the cosmos.
Yes.
None of these religions that want people to believe this and that,
mm-hmm.
and keep them there, block them from exploring. None of this religion does not have an inkling about the reality of the cosmic reality of even consciousness, the cosmic consciousness as God or as the divine
mm-hmm.
dimension.
Well,
they don't have
true.
A clue about that.
Right. Even the stories that are told, there's a much more to a paragraph than just the paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So
mm-hmm.
that's growing and learning and
yeah.
creating
yeah.
and consciously understanding and, you know, evolving. That's true. Because there's much
mm-hmm.
more than the little bit that we get bits and pieces of. It's constantly growing. You know, our Creator, the Divine, wants us to know truth and to be as full as we can be.
I tell you that for me, the greatest secret that I have come to have an inkling about is the fact that as beings, not even human or not human or whatever, you know, intelligent civilizations, they must be from all any kind of phylum, you know, but
mm-hmm.
we are apes. The ape phylum evolved into human beings with the help of the Anunnaki, but none of the beings in the universe is ever fixated. I mean, life is constantly on consciousness, especially consciousness. Life cannot be without consciousness. Consciousness
right.
cannot be without life. And
mm-hmm.
conscious life is not fixated. It keeps evolving. And this
mm-hmm.
is a great secret because it means that even in your own life, your gift, your capacity, your mental capacity, your psi capacity, your whatever, love, magical, artistic, and intellectual capacities, they are totally open. And
yes.
I don't understand why any doctrine, whatever it is, you know, philosophical, religious, whatever, should give to the people the idea that we would force the idea that we are like what we are. You know, we cannot move, and we just have to keep trying to be not too bad.
Well, it's constantly flowing.
Yeah,
constantly flowing.
There's
yes.
a lot to be released. Yeah. You know, I was reading your book, Chris, about you know, the guilt and the shame that especially women carry because of this original sin and the stuff with Eve, and it's like you can let all that go. And I really got a feeling of cleansing from reading your book. It's like you don't have to be guilty about any of this. Look at the people or look at the beings that created us. They were out of control on a lot of levels, but they didn't have any remorse for what they did. There was nobody
Absolutely.
Threatening to punish them from another higher level, really. I mean, they just did whatever. And I'm not saying we should all do whatever. We should always, I'm just saying for myself, I think, ascribe to the highest possible standards and not ever hurt other people. But, again, there's there was just so much in your book, DNA of the Gods, that I found personally healing. I really did.
But I must tell you that I went through a liberating process. You understand that I'm starting as an atheist when I'm 15 years old, and
yes.
I'm awakening to my spiritual path. I'm 18, but I'm starting as an atheist, and I did not know I was carrying such baggage.
Yeah.
And because why should I feel so liberated? I had an incredible state of liberation. Writing this book, and I said, but wait a minute. So I was carrying also this baggage.
Exactly. We all do, as you pointed out in your book.
Yeah.
And I think, again, I can't recommend your book highly enough. It is so much more than the title, DNA of the Gods. I mean, there is a real opportunity for readers, especially women, to release themselves through just reading your book. It's a remarkable piece of work. It really is.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you
Beautiful.
So much for coming on our show. I know it's so late at night for you, but you were so generous with your time and your energy, and I know I've learned a lot, Becky. How about you?
Yes. Yes, I absolutely have, and I enjoyed you so much, Chris. Thank you so much.
Well, I have enjoyed extremely also this dialogue, and I'm very, very happy that I was invited by you. Thank you so much also. Thank you, everybody.
You're welcome. And when you have more, you have another book or you have more information or you find that whetstone, you better give us a call so that we can put you back on the show.
Okay.
Well, Chris, thank you. And again, everybody listening tonight, Chris's book is called DNA of the Gods. It is available on Amazon.com. And Becky and I highly recommend it. It is something that will change your life. So please get a copy of it. And Becky, I know you have a message for somebody tonight.
Yeah. Sorry. Can I just give my blog?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Please.
My blog. Yeah. My blog is Chris little dash Hardy Hardy, and then little dash DNA little dash of the dash the dash gods at blogspot.fr.
Great. And what I will do also, Chris, is I will put this, Becky and I will put it in our newsletter for next week also. So if anybody out there didn't quite catch the URL, we will be sure to publish it for you.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank
Bye-bye.
You, Chris.
Thank you.
What a pleasure. Thank you. So go ahead, Becky, with your message.
Yes, my message tonight is for April. Know thy spirit. Nekoshia lorohusukaha. A intikimiaha. Eyo tokushia leria toshakamo. Olero to shuya nyanda tekia. Ahuma istikias ba. Bahaka itiasa, April. We are with you. And there's your message, April. Let me know what happens.
Yes, you can reach Becky. Go to supernaturalgirls.com, and you will find Becky's email so that you can send her a message that you got your message.
Yes.
So, Becky,
well,
what a wonderful evening with Chris Hardy.
Yes.
What a wonderful time, my goodness.
I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. Her book was great. Oh, my goodness.
It really is. It's a healing
yes.
book. It's alive.
Yes.
It's so much to it. Well, look, I'm so happy that also you're feeling better. You were able to come on the air tonight. I'm very grateful that you're
doing
so well.
Thank you. I am too.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
So good night, everybody. Have a wonderful week. We will be back next week with a new guest. Be sure to join us.
Night.
Good night, Becky.
Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another radio adventure with Supernatural.